This is the current federal tax developments for the week of February 1st, 2021. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, and we're doing this first week of February here from Phoenix, where I'll be recording today's session. And what we're going to look at today is a little less hectic week than last week. We do have a few things to look at, and a lot of it has to do with various things the IRS has done this week. First thing we'll talk about is a news release the IRS put out this week to deal with what's become a major problem that some clients may run into, discovering that they've had their ID stolen and was used to apply for unemployment during the pandemic. So we're going to talk about what the IRS suggests you do if you discover there is a 1099-G that has been issued for you for unemployment compensation that you never actually received. We'll also discuss the IRS's new revised Form 7200 draft that has given us our first clue about how the IRS is going to deal with the advance on the employee retention credit for 2021. The IRS announced an interim online system that will allow tax professionals to submit powers of attorney and information authorization forms. It has both good and bad aspects to it, and it is a temporary system leading to a more complete online system that the IRS plans to bring out this summer. And finally, we'll discuss an AICPA letter that was issued to the IRS regarding what the AICPA suggests be done for purposes of dealing with the Paycheck Protection Program forgiveness applications that have already been submitted and the new employee retention credit for 2021, where it turns out no longer were you barred on getting the credit if you applied for a PPP loan, but you can't use the same wages to get your PPP forgiveness and your employee retention credit. And that creates some problems for people that had applied and weren't aware that that trade-off was coming. Let's go into the first thing, this, which actually goes back to a story that came out this week. The IRS issued IRS News Release IR 2021-24. It was issued on the 28th of January, and it deals very simply with a major problem that I think a lot of us were aware of during the year, that there were ID thieves that were attempting to, and sometimes successfully, applying for unemployment compensation from the various states during the pandemic. As we were kind of aware, the states got flooded with unemployment applications when the pandemic hit. Unemployment went to new highs, and they were grossly overloaded. Well, thieves never, you know, will give up a good opportunity, and this was a great one because there was a lot of pressure to get this relief out to people quickly. And so states were trying to process this under a lot of pressure. And so a lot of identity thieves said, hey, you know what? Why don't we try to do this? And I think a lot of us during the year became aware of people who got notified or actually got the payment sent to them via debit cards or whatever. Well, that was easy because the ID thief essentially didn't manage to get it right. They didn't get the payments redirected. Well, as probably should not be surprising, some of them did manage to get the payments redirected. And now people are discovering that someone had applied for unemployment on their behalf because now they're receiving a 1099-G from the state in question, indicating they had received so many $1,000 worth of unemployment compensation, which in fact they never actually received during the year. Now, I'm sure there's another category of people that'll come up later that will discover also had their ID stolen, also had fake unemployment issued in their name, but for whom the address was actually successfully changed by the thieves as well. So the 1099 is not going that direction either. So yeah, I don't think we're done with this yet. But let's talk about that group now who did get the 1099-G and are now sitting there staring at this report of income. Well, you know, as you know, that's going to the IRS. And we would assume that a CP2000 would follow unless these people do something about that form. So the IRS is suggesting what they should do. Now, the IRS suggestion, which is no question theoretically correct, is that you should contact the state unemployment office, which I would strongly suggest anyway, because obviously there is fraudulent claims out there. And the problem is once they discover it was fraudulent, You know, they may very well come back to you, the person who had your ID stolen, and want the money from you if you hadn't reported the fact that there was a fraudulent claim filed on your behalf. So you want to get the fraudulent claim process started. But the other theory is that the IRS is suggesting that you get the state to issue a zero 1099-G. I don't know about you, but that it should work. But I also know that many times large entities have trouble issuing this. They don't want to do it, especially because these are going to dribble in over time. So there'd be a flood of all these 1099-Gs with zero balances to put in. And I can see some people just not getting these corrected, not being done timely. Now, the IRS did advise the states that in such a case where there has been a fraud, they should not have issued a 1099-G, but whether or not the states are going to fix it, that remains to be seen. So I do want to remind you of one thing, just in case you have a client that has this happen. They should try to get the 1099 corrected. They definitely should contact the state employment office. Both of those make sense. But if you can't get it corrected, or at least it's not been corrected, by the time they go to report their individual return, of course, what I would strongly suggest is you both report it and back it off. That would hopefully allow the matching to catch it and you have explanation. If the IRS does try to assess, and this will apply to those that I think, unfortunately, are going to discover that the ID thieves got the address changed as well, so the 1099-G never arrived for this particular taxpayer. Don't forget about Internal Revenue Code Section 6201D. 6201D is a very useful section that takes effect whenever you have a 1099 you receive that in fact does not represent income the taxpayer ever received. There are some requirements here, but if you follow them, you put the burden back on the IRS. They're not allowed to simply go forward from the 1099 to assess the tax. And basically what it says is the taxpayer has to raise a reasonable dispute about the payment, which in this case is I didn't get it. I have no record in my bank account of it getting it. You know, I have nothing of this sort. Fully cooperate with the IRS. You know, don't just, you know, go, well, I'm going to ignore this because, hey, you know, they can't collect it from me. I love clients who have that theory, right, about what the IRS can't do. They can't just do this. It's like, yeah, they can. And if you want to take that position, they can't just do that, then things will probably go very badly. So let's go back to what they can do and what you can do to shut this down, which is this. So fully cooperate. If the IRS wants to see copies of the bank, you know, your bank account statements, obviously you would provide those saying, yeah, there's the deposits. These are from my paychecks. There's no unemployment coming into my account, right? I have no record of this. If you fully cooperate, and again, it depends what the IRS wants to see, but the IRS is required then to go back to the state to get proof of actual payment to you and get information. And at that point, they should be able to get from the state that, okay, this amount was paid out. It was paid out to this account. You know, it was paid out to this debit card, whatever, and we're back and forth. That given the level of fraud that took place, my guess is we're going to be pretty much done with the discussion at that point, at least from the tax standpoint. So, yeah, watch out for that this year. It's definitely going to be a problem. Next up, the IRS put out on the 28th a draft version of a revised Form 7200, the January 2021 revision. If you remember, the Form 7200 is used to claim a refund by faxing this in where you have refundable payroll tax credits, which we added, you know, both the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act. We had both qualified sick pay, qualified family leave pay, and we also had the employee retention credit. If those credits are greater than your payroll tax deposit that is due, you're allowed to get the excess over that deposit refunded to you directly, and you do that by Form 7200. 7200 is faxed into the IRS. Now, this is a draft form, so the first key caveat is don't go submit it right now because it is a draft. It's not to be used until such time as the draft becomes final. And we still don't have the instructions, the draft version of the instructions, to go with this Form 7200. But what's interesting about it is the first time we have received some information about what the IRS plans to do about the Advanced Employee Retention Credit. Taxpayers, employers, I should say, this year, who expect to qualify for the Employee Retention Credit are allowed to apply for an advance. That advance is equal to 70% of the payroll that, the average payroll they had back in 2019 on a quarterly basis. And the idea is we would get this paid up front. Now, if you do that, it does offset your employee retention credit for all future payroll tax deposits. So, of course, you'd end up having to pay in the deposit at this point forward. But you'd have the cash today and you'd get the advance on the ERC. If it turns out ultimately you do not have enough employee retention credit this year to use up that 70% of your average wages from 2019 for a quarter, then eventually it'll be paid back. Be paid back, actually, technically, they are going to treat that as if they're going to just assess some additional employer FICA. That's a cleanup option only. But the answer is we're going to do this. So you want to keep your eyes open because it really was a question, how are we going to get this advance money in taxpayers' hands quickly? Now, some of you may be thinking, well, this isn't very quick. We're already one-third of the way through the first quarter. And obviously, there's going to be additional. And by now, you might have actually already used some ERC. And so you get the advance. It's like, well, I know I'm probably paying a chunk of this back. So that's up to you, whatever. Although it does appear the IRS is saying, being aware of this, that the total amount you can put on that line is going to be limited to the ERC that you would qualify for an advance. So whether you're claiming the advance or not, you're going to be limited on your 7200 at a maximum at any point in time to showing the amount that you would qualify for under the credit. So in theory, if you've already got money earlier or you've offset payroll tax deposits earlier, this should basically take care of itself in terms of not over-refunding you the money. Now, that limit on the ERC is kind of an interesting one because if you, let's say, you just didn't have much payroll in 19, you were just barely getting started, and you do still qualify because you're in a distress. You're in the period where you have a full or partial suspension of your business. So you qualify under that test, not necessarily on the reduction of revenue test. You could end up qualifying for more ERC than what you had back in 2019 based on that payroll. It does appear at least this draft is not going to let you get that till you file the 941. We will see if the final version changes that. I suspect somebody may comment on that before we go forward. Next up, the IRS is going to go part way to try to get a way for tax professionals to submit powers of attorney and information authorization forms to the IRS. This is news release IR 2021-20. It came out on the 25th of January. And this is going to allow individuals who have a secure, professionals who have a secure access account with the IRS to upload Forms 2848, the Power of Attorney form, and Form 8821, the form for for disclosure authorization to the tax professional. They're going to be allowed to upload that to the IRS as opposed to mailing in the forms or faxing the forms in. Now, part of the reason for this is, as we'll discuss, the IRS is looking to move to a fully electronic system. They're not ready to go there yet, so they're going to try this system. This system has pros and cons. And I guess it's not really a huge con, except what sounds like a really simplified way to get these things through, which it is, but it may be a problem if you need quick action. Because, as we'll discover, there's a problem here. But so the first thing is, you have to be signed up online with the IRS, and you have to be able to have a secure access account with the IRS. That includes a current username and password, or you've got to create that secure access account. So assuming you have that, then you're going to be able to effectively upload to the IRS these forms. Now, okay, that seems like no big deal, right? We do that. Is this really that much better than faxing them up to the IRS? Maybe. Let's talk about the advantage here. One nice thing about this is, you know, currently I need a wet signature, is the term the IRS is going to use, pin on paper from the client authorizing me to, you know, basically send in the power of attorney. The power of attorney is not valid unless the client has that wet signature on the piece of paper. So I have to get the piece of paper to the client has to sign it, and then I can go ahead and fax that form up to the IRS. The IRS, in this case, for the uploaded forms from professionals who have secure access, they are going to accept the forms with what the IRS will refer to as an electronic signature. So the signature could still be handwritten. Your client can still sign a piece of paper, date it, and send that back to you. Or you can use the electronic option. Now, the IRS wants to be clear, and this is where you perk up a bit. They're saying electronic signature does not necessarily mean a digital signature. A digital signature is a type of electronic signature, so the digital signature systems can work, but other methods are available. Let's talk about the difference between electronic signature and the subset called digital. A digital signature are using things like DocuSign, Write Signature, Adobe's electronic signing offer option. Those digital signature systems generally involve some form of authentication and some form of, you know, way of locking down on the document, saying this signature goes to this document, and there is a way to lock that down. Tell us where the person signed from, maybe their IP address, etc. Document various issues. Also, if you're using it for like electronic filing of tax returns, you've been used to also having knowledge-based authentication in order to prove that person is really the person they claim to be. Well, that type of system, whether with KBA or not, is not what you need for this. You can use that. So if you have your client sign with DocuSign, use Acrobat's option, you're using Write Signature, that will still work for this purpose, but the IRS will allow something far simpler. And they give some examples of this. It's just some way to get an approval on the document. That could include the client doing nothing fancier than typing their name on the signature block and type in the date. You could just bring it up in Acrobat, type your name on as a comment, type the signature. That's good enough. That'll work. It could be a scanned or digitized image of their signature that's attached to the record. So, you know, if your client has that, you know, we have that option many times. You can do that on the phone using an Adobe Sign option. Adobe has an app that lets people do that. Just sign those things. Other PDF programs will do it as well. You could have a handwritten signature onto electronic signature pad if you have that available. A handwritten signature mark or command input on a display screen with a stylus, or a signature from third-party software. That would be like the electronic type signature options. Any of those can be sent up through this system. So essentially, I can make it very, very simple for the client to download the form, let's say, from my portal, just type their name, however they get their signature on there, upload it back, I can send it in. Now, a couple of issues with this. First thing is, it's not going to be faster. The IRS still is going to process your request to get into the CAF system on a first-come, first-served basis. So it's not as if these go to the head of the line. And that's going to be a bigger problem because for all other, they will not accept these electronic signatures except via this system. And why that's a concern, I don't know about you, but sometimes, of course, I'm getting the form signed because there is a pressing IRS matter. And I can't really wait for CAF to get this, you know, into the system. Now, the IRS claims they cannot accept other than wet signatures outside of this, and the term they use is a wet signature. I love this, wet ink signature, pen to paper, is for security reasons. Right, they're using essentially, they don't say it, but effectively they're using secure access to make sure that you are the professional sending it in. And if that's happening, then they're going to accept how you're doing it. Okay? But the problem is that if I have to send in the copy of the 2848 to a person that I call on the practitioner hotline or try to deal with this issue, if the IRS is not going to accept the electronic signature if I fax it to the main line, I have a feeling they're also not going to accept it when I try to fax it to that IRS agent on the phone with me. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm guessing that may be a problem. So it may turn out that I'm still going to be better off, even though I may submit using this system, I may not use the electronic form unless I'm submitting for something that will not be pressing with regard to time. The other catch is, you can do this for your clients you already have a relationship with, no problem. However, if you do not currently have a relationship with the client, then you have to use a system to otherwise authenticate them. Now, this obviously KBA could be done with electronic signatures. That would appear to be valid, but they do have other ways of doing it. So basically, let's talk about an individual. A brand new person, a client contacts you, a potential client contacts you. They got an IRS issue, and they need a CPA to help them resolve it. So you decide, yep, I'm going to step up. I can do that, but it's the pandemic, right? So I don't really want to meet them in person to authenticate, potentially. They don't want to meet me in person to authenticate. So what we can do is I need to take the following steps. What they suggest is I need to inspect a valid government-issued photo ID. That could be a driver's license, which is most likely, an employer ID. It was those things, which I love that employer. I would assume that's if the employer is the government. A school ID, probably if the government, state ID, military ID, national ID, voter ID, visa or passport. And I can inspect that and I've got to see them. So I got to get this picture of them on the ID and I've got to see them. They do say that can be done via video conferencing or via a self-taken picture of the taxpayer. So I could just get them together on a Zoom conference. I can see, I've got to turn on their camera so I can see them. So I see them, and then they could hold up their passport or their driver's license to the screen. Now, I would probably want to use something like the built-in snipping tool. If you've ever used that in Windows, just hit the Windows key and type in snip, and you'll find out that there'll be an option there that will let you snip from the screen. And I would probably snip from the screen when they're showing the passport. Also snip from the screen when they're on the screen to show, yep, I verified it's the same person, and file that away. I also need to record the name, social security number, or ITIN number, address, and date of birth in that case. And I need to verify that information I just recorded through secondary documentation, such as a federal state tax return, the IRS notice or letter. I'm probably going to have that, right? Social security card, credit card, or utility statement, right? And if they change their address, then I could take a look at their tax return and then the utility statement to prove that, okay, the tax return shows me information about them, ID, social security number, et cetera, from last year, and then they moved. Well, I've got the utility statement that would establish their address. The IRS provides other steps for corporations, S corporations, partnerships, as well as for not-for-profits, right? And you need to retain that proof of authentication. That'll be the key. Now, the IRS then ends in describing they have a plan to go to a system eventually that will be fully electronic and result in instantaneous, they claim, submission into the CAF system. And that will be one where the tax professional will be able to sign online. The taxpayer will need to set up a secure access account, basically, but then they can electronically sign. And when they sign, then the form will be submitted. At least that's what they claim. Now, that could get interesting because normally they have to appoint us as for power of attorney, and then we had to accept, and we couldn't accept on any day before they appointed us. So what the IRS is describing would seem to be a change to that, and we'll have to see if that's what the IRS really means or if there's going to be another issue there. But that is their plan to go fully electronic. Finally, let's discuss an AICPA letter that was sent to I think at this point, probably former individuals in Treasury, because it was sent on January 15th. As you may remember, 5 days later, we changed administrations, but also to the commissioner, and presumably it was forwarded to the appropriate people currently in Treasury, or at least those who are filling in for now. With the AICPA's suggestions about how to deal with this new employee retention credit issue for 2020. The issue is pretty straightforward. We thought initially last year, remember, you could not claim an employee retention credit if you received a Paycheck Protection Program loan. Okay, so everybody who got the PPP loan, you know, they made their choice. They said, hey, the PPP loan looks like a better deal for me than the employee retention credit, so I'm going to go get the PPP loan. Understanding that, they also then knew immediately that they would not be able to do an employee retention credit. So when it came time to apply for forgiveness, a lot of them who applied last year, and there were people that did, some banks allowed it, right? And some people actually got their forgiveness. Well, I talked with people in that position. I've talked with CPAs who are working with people in that position. And many times the question arose, look, we had a 24-week period to spend the money. Payroll alone will get rid of the whole loan. Do I really have to go back and, you know, limit the payroll to just what we need for, you know, cancellation, or and also deal with all those other expenses we could have used? Because, hey, the payroll by itself would give us full cancellation. And the SBA had already told us that, no, you didn't have to submit any expenses beyond, once you had enough qualified expenses that got you forgiven, you didn't need to have any others. So there were a number of taxpayers that did just submit their payroll and also didn't want to bother with cutting it off. You know, they just submitted all payroll for the 24 weeks saying, hey, that was easiest and I don't have to worry about when we're going to cut it off and all those issues. So we just submit our documentation. That also means if there's some part of the payroll they didn't like, I have more than enough to cover me, so I get full forgiveness. And there's no downside. Then we got the new bill. And in the extension of the employee retention credit, we discovered, unfortunately, that now we have a special rule that says we cannot claim the ERC on wages that were also used for forgiveness. Now the problem comes out, what if the client basically submitted excess wages on their forgiveness form that was already processed by December 27th when the new ERC provision came into the law? Now, is the borrower, just out of luck? And the AICPA says, look, that really shouldn't be the case. Obviously, nobody knew that this was there, and people, you know, were filing for forgiveness and had no idea there's going to be this secondary problem. So what the AICPA is recommending that people end up doing is that the IRS provide guidance stating that the filing of the loan forgiveness does not constitute an election to forego the ERC for the amount of wages reported in the application form that exceed the amount necessary for loan forgiveness. And the AICPA's view, that would even include a case where we have expenses we didn't submit, but we could have submitted, and those expenses along with payroll, let's say, that was limited to what was necessary to spend 60% of the loan on payroll, that we could minimize that number. And again, some things that are payroll costs for PPP loan forgiveness purposes are not payroll costs for the employee retention credit. And we have that limit of $10,000 for 2020 on the wages. So in essence, there's an optimization option here you could work with. So can we go back and now optimize since we know about this issue? The AICPA offers a couple of examples, one of which is you just need $1 million, you know, to get forgiveness. You submit $1.5 million of wages. The taxpayer should, or the borrower should in that case, obviously be able to say, look, I can take $500,000 of those wages and I can apply them to the ERC. As well, they say, and what if we had a whole bunch of other expenses that we just didn't bother submitting because, hey, look, we were so far over the top on payroll, it didn't seem to matter. The AICPA wants the IRS to allow the taxpayer to, if challenged, submit that proof. Now, the problem is, as of right now, it's just a request and we haven't had any response from the IRS about what they're going to do. They are still talking. All we have is what we discussed last week about that very narrow exception they put in place to get your ERC refunds for last year based on you've been totally denied. So we don't really have anything yet. I'm going to hope we get guidance like this from the IRS. But again, we'll have to wait and see. The IRS has still not done anything for ERC. My own take is the service prioritized. They were given a lot to do in a very short time frame. The first priority was clearly getting the $600 checks out, so they got the computer systems updated for that. The second priority is going to be getting e-filing running for individuals. That's February 12th. I wouldn't be shocked to see this guidance come out basically following that or very close to February 12th. I think it's going to be in a position after they've got personnel, they've got the computer systems rewritten, then they can move on to dealing with the computer systems to deal with the ERC and the refund claims they may get in that regard. So, like I said, I wouldn't be surprised if the ERC, we're not sitting well into March before people can actually be comfortable with the level of relief they're going to get for the ERC for 2021 or even begin to go for claims for refund in 2020. I realize that's not very good for what's supposed to be a relief program, but I think the catch was something had to give. And the IRS is prioritizing, you know, which one of these is going to get the least squawking. And I guarantee you there's already enough squawking from the 1040 not being able to start till the 12th of February that I suspect they've decided, you know what, this ERC just is going to be one of those things that we'll deal with when it finally comes up. Well, this has been the current federal tax developments for the week here of February the 1st, 2021. Again, if you have any questions or comments, you can email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter at edzollers. I tend to post there when we do updates. We have our update site at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com where you can read the information as we post updates during the week. I also follow along on the Connect sites for a number of CPA societies. Arizona, New Jersey, Minnesota, Illinois, Washington. So if you have, you know, if you're a member of those and you post there and I see it and I think I can be of help, I'll try and chime in on those. And also, you know, we still have a few things coming up here. I will be doing a course later in February, a monthly update, another update on the PPP loan where we are with COVID stuff for the New Jersey Society will come up later this month. We'll also see about if anything else happens. Again, we're kind of getting outside of the CPE season. I suspect that unless we see a relief bill pass very, very quickly, that probably most of you, unless there absolutely is something that you have to understand right this instant, are probably going to be looking at learning that bill if it comes after tax season, unless we have to pay attention before then. But if it does turn out it's relevant, we might be looking at doing something if any new bill comes up. Otherwise, be sure to come back here next week. We'll talk to you about all the issues, what else we may find out happens. Maybe we'll get some ERC guidance so we can start working these employee retention credit refunds and whatever else may be happening here in the area of federal taxes.